Today's podcast is brought to you by an ongoing sponsor now we've been talking about for a couple of months, Four Sigmatic and their mushroom coffees, teas, elixirs. They have a book.
This is stuff that you actually do use every single day.
Mm-hmm. Up to four times a day. I have talked a lot about the mushroom coffees and cordyceps that I'll have in my morning drink, but something that they've come out with that I just started trying that I can't say enough about is the Reishi Elixir and Hot Cocoa that promotes sleep at the end of the night. Like I've kind of struggled with being wired really tight and I have a tough time getting to sleep at night. And I've found that these Reishi drinks are probably the best natural sleep enhancer that I've ever tried. Like just a nice little mellow.
Yeah, you
snooze.
Said that to me the other day. Like you've been sleeping amazing since you've been drinking this stuff.
Very big fan. Yeah. Yeah. Four Sigmatic, they've been knocking it out of the park. I like everything that they've got. Highly recommend them. And if you go to foursigmatic.com/triathlon Taryn, you can get 15% off anytime. Or if you just go to the website, you can use the coupon code Triathlon Taryn and also get that 15% off. And that is an affiliate link. So it helps us out, but help us help you. Today's podcast guest is probably one of the most famous guests we possibly could have had to talk about the vegan, whole food, plant-based lifestyle. If anyone has watched a Netflix documentary, read a book about vegan lifestyle eating, dabbled in it at all, you've almost surely come across Dr. Michael Greger, MD. Now, Michael Greger runs nutritionfacts.org, which is a nonprofit website funded entirely off donations. And it is so successful, so well followed, that the free evidence that he provides on nutritional guidelines that are non-commercial, that are not funded by any one dogma or philosophy about eating. It's just science-based nutritional guidelines and all of the books that he writes, the DVD sales, all of the speaking that he does, and he does a lot. And you will hear that in this interview. He only had a half an hour because he does so many interviews that he limits them to strictly a half an hour. And I got 1 minute more than that, and I feel like I won. But he travels around the world constantly speaking about veganism, and he's obviously said these things hundreds and hundreds of times, but he's a very knowledgeable person about this stuff, and that's why I wanted to have him on the podcast, because a lot of you are probably starting to think about becoming healthier through your triathlon journey, changing your diet a little bit, and out there in this world of keto versus vegan, we need to have both camps represented. We had Brian McKenzie talking about low-carb plant-based eating, more along the keto lines of things. He said that he stopped eating keto actually before we did the podcast with Brian McKenzie, but he still said it's more low-carb. Michael Greger, on the other hand, needs to represent the other side of that, and he is a very passionate plant-based advocate, as you'll pick up on this. He has written 5 books, Heart Failure, Diary of a Third-Year Medical Student in 2000, Carbophobia, The Scary Truth Behind America's Low-Carb Craze, Bird Flu, A Virus of Our Own Hatching, How Not to Die in 2015, and How Not to Die Cookbook that just got released this year in 2018. So just from those book titles alone, you can get a really good sense of where Michael's thoughts are for what a healthy diet should be for everyone. But I wanted to ask him a lot about how it should apply to athletes, and specifically endurance athletes. We get into that. So thank you very much for being on the podcast here, Michael. Unfortunately, NTK, No Triathlon Kim, my lovely wife and co-host, actually just finished up her last day at a job before she starts a new job on Monday. So she's wrapping up a bunch of things right this second and was unable to be on the podcast, but she's still around. Here's Michael Greger. Enjoy the interview, everyone. Michael, thank you for being on the show.
Happy to be here.
Let's get right into it. I thought that this might sound like an odd question to get started with, but I think it kind of points us down a path of why you do what you do. What did you want to be as a kid when you grew up?
I think for most kids, the spark to want to become a doctor when they grow up is watching a grandparent get sick or even die. But for me, who was watching my grandma get better. I was just a kid when my grandma was sent home in a wheelchair to die. She was diagnosed with end-stage heart disease, already had so many bypass operations, basically run out of plumbing at some point, confined in a wheelchair, crushing chest pain. Her life was over at age 65. But then she heard about this guy, Nathan Pritikin, one of our early lifestyle medicine pioneers. And what happened next is actually detailed in Pritikin's biography. It talks about Frances Gregor, my grandmother. They wheeled her in and she walked out. Within a few weeks, she was walking 10 miles a day. And though she was given her medical death sentence at age 65, thanks to a healthy diet, was able to enjoy another 31 years on this planet until age 96 to continue to enjoy her six grandkids, including me. That's why I went into medicine. That's why I practiced the type of medicine I practice today, lifestyle medicine, why I wrote the book How Not to Die, why 100% of the proceeds from all my books are donated to charity. I just want to do for everyone's family what Pritikin did for my family.
There's a lot to get into there. When you were in high school, you said somewhere that you were actually, while other people were out playing basketball or baseball or whatever it was, you were in the library doing research. Was this true?
Oh, I was in junior high.
In junior high.
Yeah. Well, yeah, throughout high school. So, yeah, I was in, they called Binghamton University now. Back then it was SUNY B. Yeah, there was a science library. It was my favorite place to be on the planet. And I'd be hanging out in the basement reading through all the journals.
What kind of research were you doing at the time? Like, what was turning your crank?
Oh, well, I would literally go down the list. If you walk in any science library, or medical library, you know, they have all the stacks with all the archives, but then they usually have a section where it's like, these are the current issues of the current journals. And they usually have a stack of like the last year. I mean, you know, they rotate through and every first of every month, they get all the new journals and they put them all out. And I just loved science. I just loved the concept of science, the scientific method. And that I would just go, you know, down the aisle and, you know, read, you know, the latest issue of Science and Nature and Lancet and, you know, anything I can get my hands on. I was just so excited because every study you find something that you didn't know before. It's like a detective novel. It's like, wow, we didn't know until now. And then all of a sudden, and then what are we going to do next? And then, you know, we need to do the follow-up, and it's just ever-growing. That was the coolest thing ever. I still find it cool. That's why I dedicated my life to it.
You kept this going, like, basically right from that transition that your grandma went through and it having an effect on you. You carried that right through for the rest of your life, obviously, still now. Would you say that your breaking out point where you started gaining a lot more notoriety with the research you were doing and your opinions, that happened in Cornell when you published that first article about mad cow disease online?
But no, I don't think that got much notoriety. I mean, what really was the breakthrough was Nutrition Facts, right? 2011, when I started putting all my work online. Because before then, it was just, I'd go around speaking and you just have to be lucky enough to be in the city, you know, at the same time that I was around I started out with VHS tapes of all my latest, of my videos and then transitioned to DVD, you know. But look, if you didn't get the DVDs, you couldn't see this stuff until I put it all online. That was really the big point of change, and I wish it was just I had done it years earlier, but it just didn't have the kind of technical know-how
at the time. What drove you to actually start putting things online? Because late 90s, like, we had the tech boom, but it still wasn't a normal thing for one or two people to say, I'm going to start a website.
Well, I mean, it was thanks to that tech boom. There's this guy Jesse Rash of the Jesse and Julie Rash Foundation up in Canada. You know, that's where they had made a name for themselves. And they were on my, you know, little subscription DVD list and enjoying, you know, the science that I was bringing to the few thousand people that I could reach. And they're like, look, they do websites for a living, and basically called me up one day and said, I'd like to put all your work online. And I said, bring it on. Let's do it. And so it was this massive in-kind donation of him, you know, getting his own staff to make the, to design the site. In fact, one of the people that he worked with is still our, you know, CTO now, who's, you know, keeps the site up and running. So it was just a philanthropist, basically, who stepped forward and said, you know, everyone deserves to have this life-saving, life-changing information. They found themselves as philanthropic entrepreneurs. They're like starting new, exciting things, then moving on to the next new project to start. But in terms of operating expenses, so once we were kind of on our feet, then basically turned the reins over, which is a little scary at the point. Yeah, by the way, now you have to pay for everybody and you have to do everything. And I was like, well, there's no way. I mean, it must cost just like hundreds of thousands of dollars to make the, keep this site going, pay the server costs and everything. Like, what do we, you know? And he was like, put a little donate button. Put a little donate button on the homepage and all your needs will be met. I was skeptical. And but I put a little donate button on. And people were just so thankful for the work that we were doing. The, you know, finally, like an objective, independent source, like evidence-based nutrition. That's what people wanted all along. And here it was. And this was like a Wikipedia model. Everything's free. There's no, like, subscription no, like, special member-only site or anything. No, everything's free for everybody. But look, if you appreciate the work we do and want to kick in a few bucks, then, you know. And we just reached, at that point, so many millions of people that if 1,000 people gives us a few dollars, we're, like, set. So so we did it. And so now we have a like, a dozen staff and, you know, and dozens of contractors. And we got, you know, like, 100 active volunteers that are just churning through the literature with me. And so now it's like a whole enterprise, all powered by just, you know, people donating to keep the project going.
Okay, so let's talk about what your findings have kind of resulted in, the philosophy that you have, and what the evidence-based nutrition standpoint kind of comes from. And I'd like to start with, as a whole, general population, what are good practices, and then start getting into the weeds about, does it change for athletes?
Oh, yeah. Not interested in philosophy, not interested in beliefs, not interested in opinions, interested in one thing and one thing only. And what is the, and that is, what is the best available balance of evidence say? What does the science say? And I mean, I think that's one of the problems, one of the reasons people are so confused. And the, of course, the food industry wants it just like, I mean, wants people to be so confused they just throw up their hands and eat whatever crap's put in front of them. But this is a standard tobacco industry tactic, is just muddy the waters and, you know, introduce doubt. But there's actually remarkable consensus going back for decades as to the core elements of healthy eating and living. And it's just a matter of, I mean, anyone's familiar with literature knows that much of what you hear in the media is just manufactured controversy. And that actually, you know, we've known what to eat forever, and it's just a matter of letting the truth bubble to the surface.
So what is that truth? Is it, I hear kind of conflicting things about your findings. Some people say that you are so adamantly 100% whole food plant-based, but reading your books, the language that you use is primarily plant-based.
Well, so the best available balance of evidence suggests the healthiest diet is one that minimizes the intake of meat, eggs, dairy, and processed junk, and maximizes the intake of fruits, vegetables, legumes, beans, split peas, chickpeas, and lentils, whole grains, nuts and seeds, mushrooms, herbs, and spices, basically real food that grows out of the ground. These are our healthiest choices, but it doesn't matter what you eat on your birthday, holiday, special occasions, the day-to-day stuff that really adds up. It's not black or white. It's not all or nothing. I mean, it's just food is a like a zero-sum game. Everything you put in your mouth is a lost opportunity to put something healthier in your mouth. And so it's like, are eggs healthy? Well, compared to what? Compared to breakfast sausage? Absolutely. Compared to oatmeal? Not even close, right? So foods aren't good or bad, but just better or worse. And so we can all, regardless of what we eat, just ratchet it up. Start eating healthier foods, you know? And so it's all about just everybody, just kind of every meal, every day we can, you know, choose to eat healthier. And, that's what it's all about.
Now, are there considerations that an athlete, because most of our followers are triathletes, runners, endurance athletes of some nature, who are, we're probably working out to the point of the exercise itself being unhealthy. Are there changes that we need to make in our diet to compensate for that? Or are there changes that we need to make in this approach to compensate for some of the things that we're going to be basically sweating out of ourselves day to day?
Obviously caloric intake, maybe as much as double. But the important thing, particularly for someone who's doing this kind of really intense endurance activity, is to, you know, counteract the inflammation, oxidation, the kind of the stress that puts on our body. And that's where plant-based diet fits right in. I mean, in terms of improving recovery time, I mean, people want to train, you know, harder, get back earlier than, I mean, that's where the science points to. So whether, you know, you can do individual foods, like there's been studies done on blueberries and spinach, I got videos on all these, where it shows with, you know, this delayed onset muscle soreness, when you do a hard workout and you're sore the next day, that's what we're talking about, where you have these little micro tears in your muscles, which actually makes you stronger in the long run, but may take a day or two for you to get back to, working those same muscle groups. Well, that's where plant-based diet can come in. That's where give somebody, you know, preloaded blueberries, and you can put people through these, various muscle strength tests, and you can show you can get, kind of bounce back in the saddle that much earlier, in fact, by days. And so, it's the training that does it. Nothing you can eat substitutes for training, but you can just train that much harder if your body can recover quicker. And that's really where the anti-inflammatory, antioxidant effects of whole plant foods can really be beneficial, particularly for endurance athletes.
Do you have a list of superfoods that might be good for athletes specifically?
I certainly have a list of superfoods, which are good for everybody. And athletes just have to eat, just because they're putting their bodies through such travails, it's even just more important for them to treat their bodies right. And so I've centered my recommendations around a daily dozen checklist of all the things I encourage people to fit into their daily routine. It's available as a free app, iPhone, Android, called Dr. Greger's Daily Dozen. So I talk about eating beans every day, berries every day, the healthiest fruits, greens every day, the healthiest vegetables, tablespoon of ground flax seeds, quarter teaspoon of turmeric, the best beverages, the best sweeteners, all that stuff. Yeah, I tell everyone else how much to exercise. And so basically just trying to inspire people to, fit some of the healthiest of healthy foods into their daily diet.
And just eat more of them to account for the caloric loss.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Now let's make the internet fight here and talk about how the keto community, like they've made massive inroads into endurance sports, much like almost all other sports, teaching people or claiming that you need to become fat adapted, and specifically for endurance athletes saying, well, you can't have nothing but sugar for 12 hours in the course of an Ironman race. You need to become fat adapted. And the only way you can do that is with butter and bacon and all this. Like, where do you fall on the, I would say, keto and veganism, almost from a whole foods basis, agree on 80 to 90% of it, but it's that last 20 that is miles apart. I guess, what's your take on that whole movement that's storming up over the last couple of years?
I mean, from any kind of scientific standpoint, it just seems just totally kooky. I mean, it almost reminds me of kind of like, I mean, this comes and go like the Atkins phase. There was a point, this is back like 2004, where, I forget what crazy percentage of Americans were following the Atkins diet. And, you know, it started, of course, in the 70s and comes back in waves. And basically telling people to eat absolutely the worst possible foods, no scientific justification. I mean, there's pseudoscientific justification, but no real scientific justification. And it just gives people good news about their bad habits. Who doesn't want to hear about that? If you're a smoker, who doesn't want to hear that smoking is good for you? And it sells a lot of books. And people get rich. And, you know, who doesn't want to be told eat bacon? Like, you know, And meanwhile, all along, these poor suckers that are telling people to eat broccoli are homeless, living on the, you know, what are they? But it's like, well, but that's what the science says is healthiest. I mean, it's just, it's crazy. I mean, so for example, you know, U.S. News and World Report, you know, ranked, I think like 40 diets this, you know, every year they do their ranking, whatever. And they literally, keto came in dead last, like 40 out of 40 or 45 out of 40, whatever the, however many they looked at, absolute dead last. And there are some like totally crazy diets on there, right? And it's just like, well, why? Well, why? Who's on the panel? They had experts. They had people that actually have scientific backgrounds. I mean, people that actually understand basic biochemistry, right? I mean, it's just like, of course, it's the worst possible diet, right? I mean, you know, global burden of disease study, for example, largest study of human risk factors in human history, funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Number one dietary risk factor for death on planet Earth, inadequate fruit consumption. Kills more people than soda, processed meat, blah, blah, blah. We're just not eating enough fruit. And here's the keto people coming along. Oh, don't eat fruit. Eat, you know, whatever. Eat butter or something. I mean, it's just nutty.
So, like, maybe you can clarify something here, that this has kind of cooked my noodle here for a while. So the keto people, they're pointing to studies where in mice, reduced risk of cancer, heart disease, yada, 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 yada. I heard Valter Longo, I think is how you pronounce it, comes in and he actually points to a study that says, well, as a matter of fact, yes, those mice, they weigh less. They have less cancer cells in their body. They are more muscular on a keto diet, but they die earlier. How in the world are, like, do both camps have it so far apart?
Well, first of all, we're talking about mice, right? I mean, it's like you can get a rodent model to show anything. I mean, that's why drug companies love mouse models, because if it doesn't work in mice, it'll work in hamsters. If it doesn't work in hamsters, it works in gerbils. And you find a strain of rats where your drug does better, you get FDA, you know, I mean, it's just like, I mean, a lot of these results, you can't even extrapolate from like male mice to female mice, and you want to extrapolate it to people. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And so you want to show something, you can find a rodent model that does it. The thing is, well, what happened to people? Well, it's like, it's almost as if no studies have ever been done on people. And so then we're stuck with rat studies. I mean, that's the role of rat studies. It's like, nothing has ever been tried on people. And so all we got is rat studies. Okay, let's talk about rat studies. But if you have actual human being studies, like Ornish's lifestyle heart trial, randomizing people reversing heart disease, the number one killer of men and women, the only diet ever in history proven to reverse the number one killer of men and women in the majority of patients, a plant-based diet, like you don't need a rat study because it's already been done on people. Right. I mean, so shouldn't that be the default diet to prove otherwise? Reverse is our number one killer. Right. And also just as a bonus, reverses diabetes and high blood pressure, other leading killers. It's like in people. And so why are we talking about rats when we have human studies? Why? Because the human studies don't say what you want it to say. You love your bacon, and the IARC, the official body that says what is and is not carcinogenic, has called, you know, bacon, other processed meat, a category one carcinogen, meaning we are as sure bacon causes cancer in human beings as we are that plutonium and asbestos and cigarette smoke causes cancer. Well, if you're a bacon seller or eater or lover, you don't want to hear that. But I'm sure you can find a Drosophila study, a fruit fly study that says bacon does something good for you or whatever. And then you put it on BuzzFeed or whatever. You get lots of clicks. Bacon is good for you, whatever, right? But it just so that's why you go to rodent studies, because of human studies. You can always find a rat study or do a rat study that will find something, some biomarker that does something that you could claim does better, because no one's going to buy your book if you say, you know, bacon's not good for you. You actually have to eat some sweet potatoes or something. God forbid.
So let's get into it tangibly. How do people effectively take this up? Over your transformation stories that you've witnessed and studied, have there been commonalities with some of the first steps that people take that make a more plant-based diet sticky, as opposed to people trying it and then bouncing off?
I think, I mean, everybody's psychology is different, but I think in general, people, encourage people to do it at whatever pace is necessary for them to stick to it. And so, I mean, and it's good to realize, like, it doesn't really matter what you eat, like, next week or next month. It's like, what are you eating the next few decades, right? And so you need to find a way for, you know, a new way of eating to fit into your life, that it's convenient, that it's affordable, that it's delicious. Like, you can do anything short term. You can hold your nose and eat whatever or take whatever, but that's not going to be sustainable for most people. And so you just look. And so if it's like, all right, I'm going to find a breakfast that I really love, right? And like the rest of the day, I'm going to eat Cheetos and crap and whatever. But like, okay, I'm going to, and then you're like, okay, you know, actually the oatmeal with the berries and the walnuts, it's actually pretty good. Like, I could totally do this. Okay. Then I got like one good go-to breakfast idea, right? Okay. And then like, all right, let's do a few options for lunch. Think I tried this. I don't like this. Oh, but hey, this hummus stuff is pretty good. Hey, I can totally dip vegetables in hummus and like that. Hey, you know, and look, and it's like 3 weeks in and they've got four or five dishes, a few snacks, whatever. That, hey, look, whatever it takes for you to be able to do this for the long run. I mean, that's really what, when it comes to health and longevity, it's what you do over time. It's not just for bikini season. And so I encourage people to take whatever time it needs. And so, you know, and not beat themselves up if all of a sudden they just had a, you know, slice of birthday cake and be like, oh, that's it. All right, forget it. Back to square one, right? So people use that as an excuse to not make the first step. If they can't go all the way, they're like, I'm not even going to do anything. No. I mean, any movement in that direction towards eating healthier can accrue significant benefits. You know, I encourage people, you know, it's not black or white. It's not all or nothing, any movement. So, you know, whatever pace. Now, if you have, you know, some serious chronic disease, then, you know, we may want to make more drastic changes, you know, to bring off some of these medications, et cetera. But if you're healthy and you got your whole life ahead of you, then whatever pace it takes to make this work in your life, then that's the pace you got to go at.
Hmm. Okay. Let's wrap up here. You are a busy fella, and I promised that I'd get you off here in about 3 minutes. And let's wrap up with a few real tangible takeaways. Fun questions here, very quick, with the preface that this is specifically for very busy triathletes. So number one, what would be the most convenient snack that you go to that you would recommend?
For someone who's really active, then we really need to think of caloric density. And so something like trail mix. So dried fruit and nuts. So very small volume, just shelf stable, you know, it doesn't need refrigeration, blah, blah, and just packed with calories per volume. So yeah, some kind of trail mix would be a good go-to.
Okay. Your favorite fruit?
Oh, my God. Whatever fruit you love. But berries are definitely the healthiest fruits. You know, it's a little more difficult to, a little more fragile. But you can actually get dried fruits. I mean, you can get, and I'm not talking about like chewy dried fruits, but like freeze-dried, you can get like freeze-dried strawberries. Super light, super easy to carry around. Of course, don't need to be refrigerated or anything. Then you can get your berry fix in. Berries are definitely the healthiest fruits, but basically whatever fruit you'll eat is the fruit that's healthiest for you.
And let's go the same for veggies.
Oh, greens, particularly cruciferous greens. So broccoli family or cabbage family greens, so collards and kale, etc. Those are the healthiest greens. In terms of a snack, something you can take with you, you can do kale chips, something like that. But yeah, we all want to get greens during daily diet. And of course, for athletes, it's all about those nitrates. Right? I mean, the reason that athletes dope with beet juice is because they're getting those vegetable nitrates. Well, guess what has more nitrates than beets? And that is green. So arugula is number one, but it's basically beets, beet greens, beet juice, and dark green leafy vegetables. That's where our vegetable nitrates are. It actually improves your efficiency of extracting energy from oxygen. So every single breath, you get more power if you have been eating some vegetables or drinking some beet juice. And so absolutely greens have to be the go-to, particularly if you're, you know, if you're doing any kind of competitive nature where, you know, seconds count.
Mm-hmm. And last one, let's say, is there a dark horse food there that is kind of an up and comer that you think doesn't get its credit?
A dark horse? I don't even know what that means, but.
An unsung hero.
Oh,
world.
Well, People don't eat enough flax seeds. That's actually one of my daily dozen. I encourage people to eat ground flax seeds every day, a tablespoon of ground flax seeds. They're just, you know, magic. We got randomized double-blind placebo-controlled studies proving few spoonfuls of the stuff can bring down blood pressure 2 to 3 times better than our leading blood pressure medications and only have good side effects. We're talking reducing risk of breast and prostate cancer, controlling cholesterol, triglycerides, blood sugars, reducing inflammation, curing constipation, tablespoon of ground flax seeds a day. Turmeric is another one that people aren't eating enough of. I recommend a quarter teaspoon a day. Yeah, there's some specific foods that really have almost kind of pharmacological benefits and only with good side effects.
We're at our time here, Michael. Where should people get started learning about all the things that you're talking about?
They can go to nutritionfacts.org, free nonprofit science-based public service, new videos and articles every day on the latest in evidence-based nutrition. What a concept. Nutritionfacts.org.
You've said that a couple of times. That's perfect. I've been there quite a bit over the last few years, getting more into plant-based food, and it's a great website. So thank you very much for putting it together, and thanks for spending some time with me.
Absolutely. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Michael. Bye-bye. Take care. Bye-bye.
If there was anything on the podcast that you heard and you want to know more about, you can visit our show notes at triathlonterran.com/topics/triathlonterranpodcast. We'll have all of the links listed there. Any other info that you may not have had time to write down or whatever, it's listed there for you in perpetuity.
Something newer, juicier, freer.
We love free.
We've had resources kind of scattered throughout the website for the past year that we've built up. Well, I have put that all on one single page on the website at triathlonterran.com/free resources. Just by entering your email address, you can get a free swim drill program, a free strength training program, a running drill program. And as we start coming out with things, everything will be there. So you can check it now. You can check it later.
Come early, come often.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be adding stuff all the time, so make sure you check it out frequently. Also, if you've got questions for Taryn, and many of you do, and you leave them in the YouTube comments, Facebook, Instagram, etc., we're trying to aggregate that all into one spot so everybody can see and hear the answer. And that's why we've now launched the Triathlon Trainiask podcast, because it's Trainiacs asking questions. So what we want you to do is head over to triathlonterran.com/Trainiask. If you have a question, you'll record it and Taryn may answer it on the podcast. He's recording them every single weekday, and you can find the podcast on every single podcast player out there. And Trainiask is spelled TRAINIASK.
Short nuggets of info. Every right. episode, I guarantee under 10 minutes.
Perfect.
And it's hard to get me to stop talking. So this is a feat. Finally, last thing that you can do is if you like this show or the Trainiask show when you check it out, head over to iTunes, give us a review, good, bad, indifferent. Hopefully 5 stars because we're pretty awesome.
Reviews just really help us out.
It really helps with the iTunes algorithm. However it happens, it works. It's internet magic and helps other new or aspiring Trainiacs discover us. So that would be much appreciated.
Thanks, folks. See you next time.